It's Monday, September 12th. Heavy is the head that wears the crown, especially when your mother carried the weight for 70 years. We start here.
God save the king.
God save the king.
As the coffin of Queen Elizabeth begins its journey across Britain, King Charles confronts his new challenge.
We know kind of too much about him for him to have any magic at this point.
How do you succeed one of the most successful monarchs in history? Ukraine said it was taking its land back, but no one expected them to do it this quickly.
This is a breathtaking move by the Ukrainians.
There's been a dramatic turnaround in the last few days. We'll break it down. And cheating is supposed to be black and white.
I can't even remember the last time something like this has happened.
So how did chess become so shady? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. She was 96 years old, but when Queen Elizabeth II died on Thursday, not even her own family was necessarily expecting it. We've now learned that in the Queen's final hours, two of her children, Charles and Anne, were there with her. Her other kids, Andrew and Edward, along with her grandchildren, William and Harry, raced to get there in time, but didn't make it.
I was stunned, and I think the news is still kind of settling in because it just seemed to happen so fast.
And if family members felt like they weren't able to say goodbye as they wished, well, this weekend, an entire nation began to say goodbye together.
It's very sad, it's very emotional. But to feel that amongst everybody who's here, I think is really special.
Yesterday, the Queen's coffin left her beloved Scottish estate of Balmoral for the last time. It arrived in Edinburgh. And between those two points, tens of thousands of mourners gathered on the side of the road. What would ordinarily be a two-hour journey took 6 hours. Later today, there will be a service and a vigil at St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh before the Queen's body returns to London, where then she will lie in state before eventually going to Westminster Abbey. But while in most families, loved ones would just gather, stay close together, a royal family doesn't get that kind of time. King Charles went to St. James Palace in London to immediately be officially proclaimed king.
The crown of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland is solely and rightfully come to the Prince Charles Philip Arthur George.
These protocols have been in effect for more than 1,000 years. In the old days, it might have been to avoid power vacuums and wars, but today, for a new king with lower popularity ratings than his mother, in this rapidly shifting world, royal watchers say a smooth transition is no less vital. So, as that nation and as the world look forward, what does it take to be a king? ABC's foreign correspondent James Longman is outside of Buckingham Palace this morning. James, of all the moments this weekend, which one seemed to matter to you most?
Brad, I think the king meeting his people in person for the first time, that was huge. It was an impromptu meeting. He got out of his car and greeted crowds right outside Buckingham Palace. And he really wanted to set the tone for what his reign will be like. You know, the Queen certainly didn't do that when she was a young woman, when she became Queen. It took her until 1970 to do any kind of walkabout. The first time that was ever done, in fact, was in 1970. So, you know, many years into her reign. So from the very beginning, Charles wants to set the tone.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set.
This will be a touchy-feely reign. He'll be much more in touch with his emotions. He understands that now in a way that his mother didn't. And for many years, he maybe didn't, right up until, I think it was Diana's passing, really, that made the whole of the royal family really understand the importance of their emotional connection to the nation. And so I think that moment where he got out of the car, greeted his new subjects, and one woman at one point grabbed his hand and gave him a kiss, and he didn't seem flustered by it at all. Can you imagine someone trying to kiss Queen Elizabeth? Never in a million years. So I think that was a big moment. I think there were some other ones with other members of the family. Obviously, the walkabout where the new Prince and Princess of Wales, William and Kate, came out to see well-wishers outside Windsor Castle, and they were accompanied by Meghan and Harry. We were told that that was an invitation by William to his brother and his wife to join them and then to talk to the crowds. That was a massive moment. All for One was one of the headlines here in the UK, you know, talking about how they got together to support each other and in memory of the Queen. And in passing, somehow, she's managed to maybe bring her family together just for a moment.
God save the King!
God save the King!
And then we got to pull the curtain back on some history. The first time ever in the history of the British monarchy, 1,000 years of kings and queens in Britain, no one has ever seen inside the Accession Council, the moment where the King becomes King officially.
I am deeply aware of this great inheritance and of the duties and heavy responsibilities of sovereignty, which have now passed to me.
We saw the television cameras inside that room. King Charles on his throne, speaking to the group of assembled ministers, signing the paperwork. That is a moment that's never been seen. And we got the pomp and ceremony. I think it was quite extraordinary, really, to see all the nations of the United Kingdom and nations around the world, the Commonwealth, from Australia to New Zealand, all proclaiming him king. So there were all kinds of extraordinary moments that 80% of Britons have not been alive to see. Many firsts over the last few days, Brad.
And then it's fascinating to me how you mentioned that Charles now kind of charts his own path for himself. And you can't imagine it's going to be all rainbows and goodwill, right? Like, what challenges is King Charles now going to face as he begins this reign?
The great issue for Charles is that we know a lot about him, and we didn't know anything about the Queen, and that was part of her magic.
The path, of course, is not always smooth, and may at times this year have felt quite bumpy, but small steps can make a world of difference.
We didn't really know who she was, what she thought, what she felt. We just knew that she existed and she was, and it was by being, that was her power. With Charles, he's had 73 years of telling us what he thinks. He's basically been a campaigning Prince of Wales.
We have to reduce emissions urgently and take action to tackle the carbon already in the atmosphere.
It wasn't really a role that had much definition before. No one really knew what the Prince of Wales was, but he made it into his own. Now he's going to have to take a step back. But the trouble is, we know kind of too much about him for him to have any magic at this point. He's got to kind of make his own magic, and that's going to be difficult for him. One thing I think is important for people to understand is that, you know, Charles might look like a bit of a bumbling buffoon to people outside of the United Kingdom. And that has been, he was lampooned for many, many years, being this kind of philandering buffoon who made Diana's life hell. He's done a lot of work to try to change that image. And actually, he may be better placed than his mother ever was, really, to properly understand a lot of the social issues that exist in the United Kingdom.
And this is the first time I ever heard of the Prince's Trust. It helped me so, so much to kind of get a feel for what I wanted to do in life.
Right.
You know, the Prince's Trust is an extraordinary organisation. It's helped something like 900,000 underprivileged kids to get actual jobs. It's not just charity for charity's sake.
The scale and scope of the threat we face call for a global systems-level solution.
He's passionate about conservation. These are issues that young people genuinely do care about. I think it's difficult for people to get their heads around the idea that this 73-year-old man who's lived this pampered life in palaces can plug in to those issues that concern 21st century people and especially young people. But he has spent a good chunk of his time interested in these issues. And I think with time, that might become clearer to people. His issue is he might not have the kind of time that he needs.
Well, and James, it was interesting you mentioned kind of the magic and almost how necessary that is, because like there's been this thing in the US happening over the weekend that I found interesting. The Queen's death, it clearly had this magic. Like, we had moments of silence at sporting events here, at concerts, like things that had nothing to do with the UK. These were not diplomatic events.
Yeah.
To which some people then, particularly from, I'm thinking Caribbean ancestry, African ancestry, former colonies, not to mention Irish and Scotch people, saying, like, what are we doing here? Like, they don't necessarily feel the magic of it all. So do those conversations get more heated now when this wildly popular Queen is no longer the one on the throne?
I think those conversations get louder now.
What do we want? Democracy! Now!
I think anti-monarchy sentiment has been growing throughout the Queen's reign, but it was kind of muted while she was alive. And a lot of people were sort of saying, well, you know, we're not going to say anything just yet. We're going to wait and see. But when Charles becomes king, then that might be the moment where we make our play. And we have started to see these anti-monarchy voices.
We think it's backward-looking, a remnant of our feudal past. We think we've got to get rid of them to go forward.
Particularly, I think, among some of the larger Commonwealth nations as well as the smaller ones. I mean, there's a very large Republican movement in Australia, for example. The Commonwealth is a funny thing. It's a group of 56 nations, and it's been growing during the Queen's reign. A lot of countries actually want to be part of it because the stated aim of it is to spread democratic principles. It's to help improve lives, to fund educational programs. And actually, there are countries who've wanted to join who had nothing to do with the British colonial experience. Countries like, for instance, Gabon, just this year, Mozambique, Rwanda. These were not countries that were under British colonial rule. And so they see the benefit of membership. The difference is there are countries where Charles is now head of state, and it's that idea about having a foreign king.
Saying we are going to kowtow to them and we are going to bend and bow and kneel to them as if they are gods. Those days are done. The monarchy is a relic.
There are a lot of voices that will say, well, why would we need a king in another country? We could be part of the Commonwealth and have all the benefits of that, but not necessarily need him to be head of state. And at the moment, I think people in Britain understand him. I don't think people outside of the United Kingdom understand him very well. And in today's very fast-paced society, where moments can go viral just like that, he's going to have to understand the optics of his office in a way that he hasn't had to really so far as Prince of Wales.
Like knowing now how many dominoes can fall off of one particular instance or event. Really interesting. James Longman, there outside Buckingham Palace. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, did Ukraine just completely reshape its war? We go to Kyiv after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Perhaps lost in all the pageantry in the UK is that way on the other side of Europe, the war over Ukraine just took a complete, well, U-turn.
This is a stunning movement, but it's been the result of a chipping away by the Ukrainians.
Ukraine's lightning advance in its northeast is a spectacular success.
The Ukrainians planned, they saw the weakness, and they struck.
As of a couple days ago, Russia's invasion had become a slow, deadly march. The thinking was they could be delayed, but seemingly not defeated. Well, then Ukraine's president Volodymyr Zelensky announced his military was launching a counteroffensive.
You know that our goal is to deoccupy our whole territory. We will be slowly, gradually moving forward.
The goal here, he said, was not to take back one or two towns. No, he said he wanted to take it all back, all the land Russia has chipped away. Well, after this weekend, that no longer sounds like a pipe dream anymore. ABC's foreign correspondent Tom Sufi Burridge is in Kyiv right now. Tom, how has the situation changed?
Brad, remarkably, I mean, this is a breathtaking move by the Ukrainians. So people might have heard about the counteroffensive in recent days. We've been talking about it a lot in relation to the south of Ukraine. In the early days of the war, Russia occupied a large amount of territory down in the south, north of the Crimean Peninsula, including a key city called Kherson. Now, the Ukrainians started pushing a few weeks ago towards Kherson. They were taking a few villages, nothing much. It was moving slowly. There was a bit of a media blackout. And then suddenly, the middle of this week, we got a huge breakthrough from the Ukrainians. And actually, it was in the northeast.
The Ukrainians announced that they were going to target their offensive in the south in Kherson, and that led to the Russians pulling a lot of their best forces away from Izyum, away from these areas around Kharkiv, relocated them there, so they were vulnerable.
It seems that they were kind of distracting the Russians in the south, pulling their attention there, and then they hit the Russians hard in the northeast and really seem to have caught them completely off guard. I mean, we're seeing videos online of abandoned Russian tanks in these cities and villages that the Ukrainians have taken, as if the Russians have basically fled in a hurry. And the Ukrainians, it's really got to be stated that up in the northeast, not far from the second largest city called Kharkiv, the Ukrainians have smashed through and taken a massive, massive amount of territory. Dozens of villages, at least three cities, a key strategic city amongst them. And the Ukrainians saying it's a tantamount to about 1,000 square miles of territory. Unbelievable.
The first question that comes to mind is, how? Like, how is that possible?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons is U.S. supplied weapons and weapons from other allied nations. That's definitely turned the tide in this war.
That is the M777 U.S. made howitzer.
To modernize Teddy Roosevelt's famous advice, sometimes we will speak softly and carry a large javelin, because we're sending a lot of those in as well.
For weeks, if not months, you know, those weapons, and we're talking about the heavy weaponry, rocket systems to hit targets behind the Russian lines, ammunition depots, command and control centers that are used to run the Russian war machine. That's been happening for a while now. We've seen the evidence. We've seen the Ukrainians hitting all those targets and key infrastructure to block off the Russian supply line so they can't get supplies so easily into their troops in certain areas, particularly around rivers. And that's been done very effectively by the Ukrainians. I mean, exactly how they sort of punch through the lines in this particular area, we just don't know at this stage. The Ukrainians have put out a sort of quite effective media sort of blackouts, maybe the wrong word, but it's a kind of shutdown on any access to the front lines. They really haven't been letting journalists in. The amount of information we've been getting out is sort of slow. And therefore, we're sort of, you know, still trying to build a picture of exactly how they did this. But it's remarkable. I think it speaks of the confidence of the Ukrainians, the morale of the Ukrainians. I think it also speaks of how Russian forces are overstretched.
The Russians have achieved minor tactical success in various parts of eastern Ukraine. But so far, Russian strategic objectives have been defeated.
U.S. intelligence has been telling us that for a while now. This is evidence of that. But I think it really shows how the Ukrainians seem to have the momentum clearly, and they're going forward now.
Well, and because there's not a great way to verify a lot of this, Russia has actually said not all of these are hasty retreats. They have admitted they're retreating from some of these positions, but some, they say, are sort of planned consolidations, the way they said with their original retreats. Overall, though, Tom, can you just help me get a sense then of where the Ukrainian military is going from here? Like, what would their endgame be? Because Zelensky says he wants it all back.
Yeah, well, right now, Brad, the Ukrainians are pushing to retake the whole of the Kharkiv region in the northeast. Okay. That'd be hugely significant. Again, a massive blow to Putin and the Kremlin. Beyond that, you know, politically, they want to recapture all of their land. They're way off doing that. So we can't get carried away with ourselves. This is Russia we're talking about, right? A massive military machine. But, you know, we're already seeing the Russian response, retaliation, hitting power lines, hitting power stations, causing massive blackouts across the country. You know, it's worth just sort of adding in here that at that Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, we've all heard about it, the concerns there. You know, again, alarming developments over the weekend, more shelling in the area. So basically, the plant lost all of its external power supply, and momentarily they had to shut the last remaining reactor down Since then, they have actually regained the external power line. But, you know, the UN's nuclear watchdog warning this weekend quite clearly that if the shelling doesn't stop, the possibility of a nuclear accident there is very real.
All steps must be taken to avoid such a scenario. Common sense and cooperation must guide the way forward.
It remains to be seen whether the Ukrainians can consolidate these gains, take even more territory, or whether Russia is going to find a way to hit back.
Right, so even beyond this military push, still a lot of concerns on the Ukrainian side as well. Tom Sufi-Burridge in Kyiv, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, was it cheating or just a lucky break for a rookie? You better check yourself. One last thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. There were some incredible athletic achievements this weekend. The NFL season began, we got new US Open champions, but we've also got one of the biggest competitive scandals in years emerging in the game of chess.
Folks, I don't know what's going on. Let me know your thoughts in the comments. This is completely nuts.
So here's the story. Right now, there's been this big chess tournament in St. Louis, one of the biggest of the year. The favorite, of course, was Magnus Carlsen, the Norwegian prodigy that's achieved the highest ratings in the history of the game. No current player is really considered close to his skill level, except he lost. And he didn't just lose, he lost handily to a 19-year-old American named Hans Niemann.
It must be embarrassing for the world champion to lose to me. I feel bad for him.
Niemann is obviously good enough to attend this invite-only tournament, but he's not considered particularly amazing.
Probably as bad a body posture I've seen on Magnus in ages. I mean, he's just like,
This is not great, yeah.
Carlsen's response was to leave the tournament entirely, which apparently is just not done, ever.
What can you say?
I can't even remember the last time something like this has happened.
Like, unless you've got a medical emergency, it is considered extremely uncool to bail. Suddenly, scores were all messed up, matches against Carlsen had to be wiped off the board, making chess players wonder, was something wrong here? Carlsen did not quite say, but he did put out a cryptic tweet suggesting something wasn't on the level, which raised the potential specter of cheating. Other elite players started chiming in, noting that Niemann's recent rise in tournament play was unprecedented in the thousand-year history of the game. Niemann has claimed he just studied Carlsen's previous games and had happened to prep for the right series of moves.
But he says, what does it say? But if he had looked at this in the morning before the game, he would know that Queen H4 is not a move, and it just loses.
Because the guy you're hearing there, that's not some rando. That is Hikaru Nakamura, one of the best players in the world, openly skeptical of Niemann.
Okay, if Magnus never has played G3, if he's never played G3 before, then I'm really, really saucy.
And here's where the story gets weird. In defending himself, Niemann actually made the surprising admission saying he had cheated when he was younger.
So I cheated in random games on chess.com. Now, I was confronted, I confessed, and this is the single biggest mistake of my life.
It's easy enough to cheat online. All you have to do is feed a position into the chess supercomputer and see what it advises you to do. But the fact that he acted like this wasn't a big deal when he was 16 years old riled up people even more. And chess.com, which hosts a lot of these online games, removed him from the site because of what they describe as information that contradicts the amount and seriousness of his cheating. Translation, they're saying he's cheated more in the past than he's even admitting. Now, in all these public comments, no one, not Magnus Carlsen, no one, is openly claiming Niemann cheated or even explaining how they think he would have done it.
I mean, all of my colleagues are pretty much paranoid.
Like, what would you do in live play? Have someone in front of a computer feeding moves into your earpiece?
Someone would have to plant a communication device in the bathroom or some...
The tournament directors actually subjected him to a televised wanding searching for electronics, which they didn't find. Some have pointed out the simplest explanation is still that Magnus Carlsen lost, fair and square, and now the man who's publicly said he wants to prove himself to the youngsters out there is just being a sore loser. But if Hans Niemann fails to pull off these gambits in future tournaments, Queen to H4 won't be the only move he has to answer for. I'm not a chess player at all. Like, I know that horse can hop around, but you know how I knew this story was gaining traction? When my mom called to ask me, how would you cheat in a chess tournament exactly? So don't worry, you guys, Catherine Milkey is on the case. Hit us up with a rating and review wherever you listen. It really does help us out. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.